attorney, advocate, author, public speaker, The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600. Flip that switch and turn on your brain. Here is Lisa Wexler.
It's a Friday, and it's 6 minutes after the hour. Welcome back to the show, 203-333-9422. We will keep the lines open in case you would like to ask questions or give comments to our next guest. Joining us now, Representative Themis Claridis, who is the minority leader in our great Connecticut legislature, representing the Republicans in the House. She herself was elected to the House of Representatives as a Republican in 1998 from the 114th District, serving the towns of Derby, Orange, and Woodbridge, and she's been reelected every term since. Themis, hello, and welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hi.
Well, always great to be talking to you, Lisa.
Well, thank you so much. So I'm excited because I think that Senator Fasano's proposal makes a lot of sense, because we have a record high $2.5 billion rainy day fund. There are many people who think that that balance sheet is too high, that as a percentage altogether, 13%, it's too much, and that some of that money does need to be set aside. And I like the idea of paying down debt so that we're not paying more interest on it, which leaves up the money to be used for other good things like transportation. And I'm excited, Themis, at the prospect that maybe we can reach a compromise without tolls. What do you think of this plan?
Well, I mean, first of all, as you know, we've been staunchly against tolls from day one. So we all agree that transportation needs as much investment as humanly possible, but we didn't agree on the funding source. So the House and Senate Republicans both put together transportation plans. We have not put ours out as of yet, but they are conceptually the same. We have the same concept as to how to fund. They're a little different in how they get there, but conceptually they're the same. And most importantly, they have no tolls. As far as the rainy day fund goes, listen, we have notoriously kept the rainy day fund too low. This is the first time, I think, ever that there's been this much money in the rainy day fund. But
it is. It's at a record high.
Right.
It's at a record.
Yeah. But there's a reason. But there's a reason why. It's not because all of a sudden we're flush with money,
okay,
or the economy's gotten better. It's because in 2017, if you remember, we did that bipartisan budget.
Yes.
Without Governor Malloy, Republicans in the House and Senate and Democrats in the House and Senate came together because there was basically a tie in the legislature. So the Democrats couldn't do what they usually do and just start passing things on their own. And we came together, we put a budget together. But in that budget were things that Republicans have been fighting for decades, fiscally responsible things, things you do in your house every day. You don't know what they're called, but you know you have a spending cap in your house. You know you can only spend a certain amount of money. The state of Connecticut has not had that until 2 years ago. A bonding cap. You know you can only afford to borrow a certain amount of money. We didn't have that in Connecticut. We now have that. And we had what we call a volatility cap, which is what has allowed the rainy day fund. Now, let's remember, the rainy day fund is a budget reserve fund. There's different names for it. But it's what you have when, for example, you take out a mortgage and you know you have to pay X amount every month, but you put aside, whether it's monthly or annually or however you do it, a certain amount of money for things like the roof starts to leak.
Mm-hmm.
There are actual problems you cannot put aside for
right.
a rainy day. That's where the term came from.
Right.
So ours, in 2017, we had a huge influx of money into the rainy day fund because, if you remember, back in 2007, then President Bush put together a repatriation bill that said anybody who has offshore money has to kind of get it back here, and we're going to give you 10 years.
Oh.
And that 10 years was up December 31st, 2017.
Oh.
So, of course, what did everybody do?
They wait till the end.
They waited till December 31st, 2017.
Wow.
So there was over $1 billion that came in
wow.
that we put into the rainy day fund. So that started the cushion, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And then we passed this volatility cap that says of any money that's coming in, a certain percentage must go into the rainy day fund. Absolutely no how, no questions, no how. So that's why it's the way it is now, because we passed 2 years ago. It didn't happen by accident. But there's conditions within it that if there's, a three-quarters vote by the legislature, you can use it to do certain things like pay down pension or different things.
Okay.
You know, but because you would assume if there's a three quarters vote, that means one party cannot control that vote.
Yes,
and those that's a very serious number of a vote.
Yes.
So I don't think there's too much money in there by any means, because this state has been in a perpetual rainy day for over 10 years.
Do you think that they're okay? Then what about that aspect of Senator Fasano's plan? Do you think it's a non-starter, or you think some of it will come down?
Okay, we have traditionally tried to do everything we can to not go into the rainy day fund.
Okay.
And that is certainly a controversial part of this plan, and he recognizes that, and he and I have talked about it at length. You know, our argument about it is there will be $2.7 billion in that fund by the end of this fiscal year. So taking out $1.5 billion will leave a little over $1 billion in it. And you know, that's not a lot of money, and it's not as much money as we need to be in there. But we could argue that this is a rainy day. I mean, listen, everybody agrees, whether you're Republican, Democrat, whether you live in Greenwich or Brooklyn, Connecticut, that the state of Connecticut needs to have a dedicated revenue stream for transportation. I would also add to that argument that the money that goes in there needs to actually stay in there. And that's been a bigger issue we've had in the state. And so if this isn't a rainy day, what is?
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? It's a controversial part. We recognize that part. But I will tell you this. What the House and Senate Republicans are is united against tolls. And we have many alternatives. We have the alternatives in that plan. We have alternatives in our plan. As I said, they're conceptually the same. And we are ready, willing, and able to sit down with the governor and the Democrats, which I've been asking for months, to find out what we agree on, because we have common ground on certain things, and figure out a way to fund it.
Do you think that the let me ask you this, Themis. Have you already sat down with your version of the plan with Senator Fasano to iron out any differences, if any, between the House and Senate in terms of the Republicans?
Yeah, he and I have talked about all this stuff. The issue now is we all recognize, okay, clearly tolls are off the table for the legislature.
Okay.
That the governor's plan is never going to pass on its own with or without tolls. There's going to be parts of it that we work. There's part of Len's plan, part of my plan.
Okay.
There's not going to be one plan that is the end all answer to this. And we all recognize that.
Right.
There's issues. There's no perfect plan and there's no great plan. But there are better plans than others. And our ideas from our plans should all be on the table so we can figure out the best final answer. I mean, when you look, what infuriates me about the Special Transportation Fund and how transportation has been dealt with in this state,
mm-hmm.
as you know, of all the state employees in the state, we pay them their wages, their health care, and their pensions out of the general fund, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's where it should come out of. Do you know that DOT employees, some DMV employees and some environmental protection employees get paid out of the Special Transportation Fund?
No, I don't even understand
their wages, their wages, their health care, and their pension. That's preposterous.
Totally.
If you want to fix this fund and make sure that the money that is supposed to be dedicated to transportation goes into the fund, then you should make sure that almost every dime in that fund is used for transportation projects, fixing bridges, building bridges, fixing roads, building roads, the things that we all think they should be used for. There's like $1.9 billion in that fund, and only $700 to $800 million are used for actual transportation projects. You know why that happened? Because years ago, before I was there, somebody decided, listen, if we take DOT and some DMV and some environmental protection out of the general fund and put it into the special transportation, we can open up some room in the general fund so we can use more of that money for something. End of story. That's exactly how it happened. I wasn't there, but I've heard.
You know, Themis, we're chatting with
the problem with budgeting.
I was going to say, we're chatting with Themis Claridis. Well, that's the trust gap, right? I mean, that's the reason why Connecticut citizens, when they're asked about tolls, say, I don't care what you're telling me. I don't trust you. I don't trust you. And that's why. That's why.
It is. It's a trust. I mean, look at it. Under Governor Weicker, there was an income tax that wasn't supposed to be forever. Never went away. Conveyance tax.
Never went away. Only went up. It just went up.
Exactly. Conveyance tax, all these taxes, we use that word sunset. Nothing. There's never been a sunset in the state of Connecticut as far as our budget. Ask the hospitals. The hospitals were in such a bad situation that Governor Malloy, way back when, said, listen, if you agree to pay an additional tax, I'll take that money down to Washington. They'll do their little mumbo jumbo, and I'll bring the money back. So at the very least, you'll be even. If not, you'll get more money. They've never gotten that money back, so they had to sue the state of Connecticut. We spent the last year with the governor's office and the hospital association, like, embroiled in negotiations that just finally completed the other day because they had to sue the state to give them what they were promised. So the problem in Connecticut is there is no trust with the people that lead the state because they never keep their word. So why are you ever going to believe that a 40-cent toll is going to stay 40 cents?
Never.
They're like drug addicts,
never.
Lisa. It's like they're like drug addicts. It is. It's like you can't put drugs in front of a drug addict. If there's a revenue source in front of these people that run the state, they will use it and use it and use it.
Well, Themis Claridis, your passion and your commitment to the public interest is evident. I thank you for that.
Well, you know, I thank you for what you do. And this is a team effort with all of us. And we're very committed to finding a way that is absolutely positively not tolls, because transportation is absolutely a priority. And if we're going to do that, then they have to stop spending more money than they did the year before and stop raising your taxes and using money for things they shouldn't use them for. We should take that money and put it where we all agree it needs to go, into transportation.
Do you think that Governor Lamont is going to be able to be persuaded that he can come out a winner on this as a governor with a true agenda and plan in a bipartisan fashion? Because I see this as a true potential political win in a good way for the state of Connecticut and for Governor Lamont, if he can lead in a bipartisan fashion. What do you think?
You know, I can't tell you what he thinks or doesn't think. You know, I think he...
No, but do you think it will look like a win for him? If he go, in other words, if he can say, I brought something to the table, we heard from the Republicans, we compromised, hurrah, hurrah. Do you think that he can sell that?
I don't think he has a choice.
Okay.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I also think that, you know, we had a former governor who couldn't make it happen, right? Governor Malloy. He couldn't make it happen. I don't know if it was his personality or his politics or a combination, but he couldn't make it happen. And I'm just optimistic that maybe with Len Fasano and with you and with Governor Lamont all saying, this is our rainy day, let's bite the bullet and do something, that we all emerge winners here in Connecticut, all of us, because we're
right.
Governing.
But that doesn't mean there aren't other options, too. And we're not going to figure those out until we all sit down together. I mean, the Governor Malloy's plan for tolls was, if you remember, there was his transportation plan was $100 billion for 8 million years. Remember that? I mean,
yes.
Just not realistic.
Yes.
Just not realistic. Great idea. Great sentiment, not realistic. You know, and certainly, you know, there were issues with him getting things done. But the problem is that there's a trust issue in the state. Back
yeah.
to that. And every time you talk about anything, you get back to the trust issue.
Yeah.
And nobody believes it's going to happen, because you know what? It's not. If those tolls went in, there's no way they're staying at that number. There's no way, when you have an unlimited spigot to turn on, that anybody's ever going to do it. There'll be some excuse why we need to do it for this, we need to do it for that. So as far as Governor Lamont, I mean, I can't tell you what he's thinking, but I do know this. This is not a winner, and he has to back down on it,
mm-hmm.
because it's not going to pass the legislature.
Right,
I got it.
We
saw that with the Senate Democrats coming out the other day.
Yes.
And so, you know, I certainly think that we all pick and choose our battles,
mm-hmm.
and he chose this one, and that's his prerogative to do so,
mm-hmm.
but you have to be able to pivot. And,
yeah, I agree
you know,
with
I
that.
I think you're a winner, mm-hmm. if you do what the state wants and what the state needs.
So, Themis, when do you go back in session?
The first week of February.
Oh, not until then.
But remember, we still have that restaurant bill to fix.
Yeah, I know.
We still have not done the bonding package, because the governor's been holding it hostage over tolls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, which is horrific, because towns and cities need this money.
They need the money
that they've been promised,
yes.
for their roads and then for snow plowing and
oh,
everything.
Yeah. It's going to get ugly. Yep.
The hospital bill just finished. We have to go in and do that. You know, these things need to get done. They need to get done soon. But you know, now we're coming up on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and everybody's out there with their schedules as to when we can go in. I mean, I would have done it yesterday if we could. So we're, you know, this has got to be done in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Themis Claridis, thank you very much. We know that you interrupted your schedule to come on at such short notice. We very much appreciate hearing from you. And again, I come back to your passion, your commitment, and your thorough evaluation of the facts. Thank you. Thanks for being on the show, and thanks for doing what you do.
Thanks, Lisa.
Pleasure. Themis Claridis on the Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600. Okay, well, if social media is to be believed, well, let me put it this way. Marie Yovanovitch is testifying on the impeachment inquiry, and Chris Wallace, who is hardly a left-wing liberal, says that if you haven't been moved by her testimony today, you have no pulse. So why don't we hear from her directly? This is live testimony coming from Washington, D.C., and we can go back and forth to telephone calls and hear from you. At 203-333-9422, this is Marie Yovanovitch, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
Great empathy for others, like the Ukrainian people who want to be free. I joined the Foreign Service during the Reagan administration and subsequently served three other Republican presidents, as well as two Democratic presidents. It was my great honor to be appointed to serve as an ambassador three times, twice by George W. Bush, and once by Barack Obama. There is a perception that diplomats lead a comfortable life, throwing dinner parties in fancy homes. Let me tell you about some of my reality. It has not always been easy. I have moved 13 times and served in 7 different countries, 5 of them hardship posts. My first tour was Mogadishu, Somalia, an increasingly dangerous place as that country's civil war kept grinding on and the government was weakening. The military took over policing functions in a particularly brutal way, and basic services disappeared. Several years later, after the Soviet Union collapsed, I helped open our embassy in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. As we were establishing relations with a new country, our small embassy was attacked by a gunman who sprayed the embassy building with gunfire. I later served in Moscow. In 1993, during the attempted coup in Russia, I was caught in crossfire between presidential and parliamentary forces. It took us 3 tries, me without a helmet or body armor, to get into a vehicle to go to the embassy. We went because the ambassador asked us to come. And we went because it was our duty. From August 2016 until May 2019, I served as the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. During my tenure in Ukraine, I went to the front line approximately 10 times during a hot war to show the American flag, to hear what was going on, sometimes literally as we heard the impact of artillery, and to see how our assistance dollars were being put to use. I worked to advance U.S. policy, fully embraced by Democrats and Republicans alike, to help Ukraine become a stable and independent democratic state with a market economy integrated into Europe. A secure, democratic, and free Ukraine serves not just the Ukrainian people, but the American people.
And that's Marie Yovanovitch, who is giving her testimony today before the House Intelligence Committee, 203-333-9422, as the impeachment proceedings continue. Question for you today, among others, is what do you make of it? And have you had a chance to listen to Ms. Yovanovitch's testimony this morning? It is apparently getting very strong reviews, because you know that everybody is a judge of everybody else, and everything is about perception. And the perception thus far is that she is a committed lifetime public servant who has served between Republican and Democratic administrations without fear or favor, as they say, and that she felt that this entire fiasco, this entire situation with President Trump elbowing his way into a brand new president was beneath the dignity and did not serve the interests of the United States of America. And that is her very strong testimony today. Now, whether or not that's going to persuade anybody in the country who hasn't already made up their mind, I have no idea. But that is her testimony, and I think it's frankly vastly stronger testimony than that which began on Wednesday when so many more people were paying attention. It is 1128, 203-333-9422. You know, I always hunt for good stuff to do on the weekend. Would you believe Sophia Loren is coming to the Ridgefield Playhouse? The one and only Sophia Loren. It's true. She is going to be at the Ridgefield Playhouse. I think it's tomorrow night. What's 1116? Are we on the 15th today, Christian? Is today the 15th? I think today's the 15th, right? So tomorrow night, she'll be there at 8 p.m., which is described as an evening with an icon and a meet-and-greet photo opportunity available. Margaret Cho is tonight. She was on the show recently. That's fun. That's at Ridgefield, too. And actually, on Sunday night, I think I'm going to go see Amy Curland in the documentary about country music, about the Bluebird Cafe. But I also see that Charlie Daniels is coming to the Oakdale Theater in Wallingford tonight. And I've seen him in concert. He's pretty great. You know, he does his Devil Goes Down to Georgia thing. And Lisa Lampanelli, now you've got to be in the mood for a foul mouth to enjoy her. But Lisa, because you know where I saw Lisa Lampanelli? I'll tell you. My sister for years was on the board of the Eric Trump Foundation, which was devoted to raising money for St. Jude's Hospital. And I would go to the annual fundraiser. This is before Donald Trump was president. And the last fundraiser that I went to for St. Jude's, Lisa Lampanelli was the guest. Now, you know, it's a fundraiser for a very family-friendly. I mean, what could be more family-friendly than St. Jude's? And Lisa Lampanelli opens her mouth and there isn't anything filthy. There isn't anything but filth that comes out of it. And you know me, right? I'm sort of prudish. I'm sort of a squeamish gal. And I don't like to hear bad words. I really don't like them. I don't watch violent television. I try and avoid that which I can avoid in life to make my life more pleasant. Now, Lisa Lampanelli, for some people, is very funny. She's very cutting. She's bright. She's bright as can be. She's a Connecticut gal. And she's going to be at the Waterbury Palace tomorrow night at 8 p.m., tickets are $35 and up. The show is called Lisa Lampanelli's Losing It. And, you know, she's an interesting character because she started out very, very fat. And her act was about making fun of, I guess, herself and other people. And then she got very thin. She had gastric bypass. She dramatically changed her look, very short hair. I mean, she used to have longish hair and she was very heavy. She was a completely different physically looking human being. But anyway, she knows how to get down and dirty. Some of the jokes, after she says them, she says, too much, too much. And it is for me. Joan Rivers, at the end, was like that too, you know. I don't like bad words. Like, you know what it is? I'm like a Jerry Seinfeld person. In the sense that I think you have a lot more talent if you can be funny without resorting to curse words. Because when people laugh after they hear curse words, it's not a laugh full of wit or understanding or empathy. It's a laugh that's a cheap laugh. It comes from the embarrassment that we all feel in a public setting at hearing a curse word at an inappropriate time. And of course, we become desensitized to the F word. It's again and again and again. It's in music. It's in backgrounds. It's everything. But when a comedian is on stage and they have to go blue, I never have quite as much respect for them as if they can make me laugh in a different way, in a clean way, without having to go blue. And that's one of the reasons why I always admire Jerry Seinfeld. It's 1132, 203-333-9422. So that's some of the happenings that are happening within striking distance, within easy driving distance of you. And by the way, this week was a big week for fundraisers. I went to two of them just since Monday. On Tuesday night, I went to the Fairfield Theater Club. And I saw Nobody's Fool with Paul Newman. Did you ever see that? I don't know how I missed it. Richard Russo, the author of the book, was there. And so was Melanie Griffith. And it was a wonderful event. And Lissy Newman was part of the proceedings. And James Naughton, the actor who lives in Weston, was an MC of a talk after the movie. I thoroughly enjoyed myself. The food was fabulous. And it was for a great cause, because what could be better than the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, which is right here in Connecticut, up in, I think it's Ashford, Connecticut, is the first one. But now they serve tens of thousands of kids all over the world. And then on Wednesday at the Westport Library, there was the 10th anniversary of the Fairfield County Community Foundation's core group that they established, which helps aid other nonprofits in organizing and running nonprofits. So if, for example, you're on the board of a nonprofit or you work for a nonprofit, you may want to reach out to the Fairfield County Community Foundation and hear what free services are available to you to help you in the nonprofit world do a better job at what you're doing. It's 1134-203-333-9422. We'll be right back. It's a Friday. Does that make you happy? And by the way, the weather's getting warmer. It's getting a little bit warmer. We had a little bit of a cold spell. You know, you would think listening to the weather people that, you know, we're not used to it going below 30 degrees once in a while. You know what? You throw on a jacket. It's not the end of the world. 203-333-9422. Now, if you're somebody without heat or you're homeless, God forbid, then it's a different story. But for the rest of us who aren't, I mean, you know, they jack us up, you know. They get us all crazy. When the truth is, they really don't know when the big storm is coming, right? Like Superstorm Sandy took everybody by surprise. Who are we kidding? So, you know what I do with the weather, right? I get up in the morning and I look outside. That's what I do. 203-333-9422. There's just so much that crowds my brain that I can worry about. I can't worry about the weather, too. It is a Friday. What are you doing over the weekend? Call me at 203-333-9422. So we have Marie Ivanovich talking about right now live testimony. I'm going to go back and forth. I want to hear a little bit more about what she's saying. Her testimony is getting a tremendous amount of people are reviewing it in a very positive way. When someone like Chris Wallace from Fox News says how compelling it is, I think it's going to force everybody, even those with an already closed mind, to take a look and hear what she had to say. Remember, this is a lifelong diplomat. And as we heard from the general earlier in the show, from General Pittard, who was the head of the armed forces in the ISIS-Iraq situation in 2014, the State Department works so hard, has such an important mission of diplomacy. What is diplomacy? Diplomacy is peace. Right? The military is war, diplomacy is peace. And I think that we really cannot and should not undermine the extraordinary devotion and sacrifice that many people in the State Department quietly and anonymously do every single day in order to advance the cause of world peace. So let's hear what she has to say right now.
Learned how little it takes to remove an American ambassador who does not give them what they want. After these events, what foreign official, corrupt or not, could be blamed for wondering whether the U.S. ambassador represents the president's views? And what U.S. ambassador could be blamed for harboring the fear that they can't count on our government to support them as they implement stated U.S. policy and protect and defend U.S. interests? I'd like to comment on one other matter before taking your questions. At the closed deposition, I expressed grave concerns about the degradation of the Foreign Service over the past few years and the failure of State Department leadership to push back as foreign and corrupt interests apparently hijacked our Ukraine policy. I remain disappointed that the department's leadership and others have declined to acknowledge that the attacks against me and others are dangerously wrong. This is about far, far more than me or a couple of individuals. As Foreign Service professionals are being denigrated and undermined, the institution is also being degraded. This will soon cause real harm if it hasn't already. The State Department as a tool of foreign policy often doesn't get the same kind of attention or even respect as the military might of the Pentagon. But we are, as they say, the pointy end of the spear. If we lose our edge, the U.S. will inevitably have to use other tools even more than it does today. And those other tools are blunter, more expensive, and not universally effective. Moreover, the attacks are leading to a crisis in the State Department as the policy process is visibly unraveling. leadership vacancies go unfilled, and senior and mid-level officers ponder an uncertain future. The crisis has moved from the impact on individuals to an impact on the institution itself. The State Department is being hollowed out from within at a competitive and complex time on the world stage. This is not a time to undercut our diplomats. It is the responsibility of the department's leaders to stand up for the institution and the individuals who make that institution, still today, the most effective diplomatic force in the world.
That's a little bit of Marie Yovanovitch, who is stating her case and stating it with a tremendous amount of eloquence. She may be the Oliver North of these hearings. You remember Oliver North. Oliver North, who was so compelling in the Iran-Contra hearings and who became, frankly, the hero going forward on behalf of President Ronald Reagan. So Marie Yovanovitch, with a very different point of view than Oliver North had, is staking her claim that right now the State Department is being eviscerated from within, that it's demoralized, and that the blame for this is really at the feet of the Trump administration, which is pursuing its own political agenda, according to Marie Yovanovitch. So the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine is getting her day in court, so to speak, and she will be taking further questions from the congressman coming right up. I'm Lisa Wexler. It's 11:42. We're cutting back and forth. I'd like to hear from you. Have you been listening this morning? Over 13 million people listened on Wednesday. If you're one of the people who've been listening to Marie Yovanovitch, I think that Americans are going to be forced to have to take a second look if they have prejudged this based on Wednesday's testimony. 203-333-9422 on the Lisa Wexler Show. And some news you may have missed. $309 million in lottery prizes have gone unclaimed since 1997. And that's extraordinary. And unlike the number that you can find on the unclaimed assets in the Connecticut Treasury, which you can find any day of the week 24/7 online by plugging your name in. And if you haven't, you should, just for fun. Unlike that, these lottery winnings, these lottery winnings are lost if they are unclaimed. So basically, it's use it or lose it in terms of if you have not gotten the lottery by the time that you're entitled to, your ticket expires and you don't get the money. The figure includes unclaimed prize money from scratch-off lottery tickets and games like Lotto, Powerball, Mega Millions, Lucky for Life, and Cash 5. Since 1997, there have been $167 million in unclaimed funds from draw games and $141 million from scratch-off tickets. In July and September of this year alone, close to $3 million was unclaimed by lottery winners right here in Connecticut. So much money is left on the table. In the case of draw games, prizes expire 180 days after the drawing is held. Scratch-off prizes expire 180 days after each individual game ends. And you can look this up at ctlottery.org. But I have to tell you, I think 180 days isn't fair. I think it should be longer. It used to be 1 year. The agency sets its own deadline. I'm not sure this is set by statute at all. And they went to 6 months because they don't want people to get the lottery money if they miss it. But I think that an issue of fairness is here. And we should give people more than a reasonable time to claim that money. Now, what does the state do with the unclaimed prize money? Well, they can either put it back into the state's general fund. They can use it to increase lottery ticket sales. They can go to a paid promotion or a free ticket giveaway. Sometimes they can augment future prizes and make jackpots higher. So it just seems to me, it doesn't go into the, I mean, so here's what it is. If you thought that you won a lottery and that the winning of it was something that you could always claim if only, you know, you found the ticket or you find a ticket and you think, ooh, let me check it. If it's expired, you're done. The state of Connecticut's pretty stingy about it. If you don't find that ticket within 6 months, you're out, and you're never going to be able to get that money. And I guess that means gamblers beware. Are you a gambler if you buy a scratch-off ticket, seriously? Or are you just somebody who says you never know? 203-333-9422. We are going back now to, well, in a moment, the House Intelligence Committee questions will resume, asking former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch further questions. She just made a statement, and the committee is now taking a break before she will answer specific congressional questions. It's 11:46 on a Friday, 203-333-9422. And welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. How are you today? 203-333-9422 is our numero. Let me give you some other news you may have missed. In the Jennifer Doulos case, the attorney representing Michelle Traconis in the criminal charges filed against her is trying to avoid another deposition. Attorney Andrew Bowman, he does not want Michelle Traconis to be involved in the $2.5 million lawsuit that was filed by Gloria Farber, Jennifer's mother. Jennifer Doulos, I wish I could report to you, has been found, but she hasn't. And now the allegation is that he fears that his client will ultimately be charged with murder or possibly homicide, and therefore he doesn't think his client should have to testify in a civil proceeding. He says law enforcement's investigation concerning the disappearance of Jennifer Doulos has not concluded. It's a continuing investigation, which may or may not result in a homicide charge or in a conspiracy charge. And so because of that, he says she should not have to provide sworn testimony in a civil lawsuit. He lost his first bid to try and get her not to have to answer a subpoena. And then he instructed her, when she had to show up, to invoke her Fifth Amendment rights to every single question asked by Farber's attorney, Richard Weinstein. So basically he's having his client clam up because he's afraid that anything she says under oath can and will be used against her in a different proceeding in criminal court. And we know that Jennifer Doulos hasn't been found, and we know that that the Doulos family believes, and so does the New Canaan Police Department, that bodily harm came to her, that she did not disappear and leave her five children of her own will and accord, and that something happened on the morning of the Friday before Memorial Day weekend, and that she has simply vanished. And again, the body has vanished. So it's a very, very sad case, but it's a case that we return to a lot on the Lisa Wexler Show, because I really don't think that just because time has elapsed, it means we shouldn't be thinking about her and thinking about her family. And in the meantime, Fotis Doulos is going about his life, although he has an ankle GPS monitor. He's not in jail. And Michelle Traconis is not in jail. And the children are being cared for by their grandmother. And Jennifer's not here. In another criminal case in our own region, Scott Hapgood, 44-year-old UBS banker from Darien, who was accused of killing the Anguillan hotel worker Kenny Mitchell, has been advised by his own counsel not to return to Anguilla. And this narrative is that Mitchell showed up at Hapgood's hotel room with a knife demanding money. That's what the Hapgood family says happened. There was a fight. Mitchell died an hour later. Hapgood was charged with manslaughter. Hapgood made bail in Anguilla and then returned to the United States. But this month, he refused to return back to the Caribbean because his lawyers advised him that he would not get a fair trial there. And not only not get a fair trial, but he might be put into jail pending the outcome of a trial, and bad things could happen to him in that jail. He is now considered a fugitive from justice because Anguilla is part of the British. It's subject to the British extradition treaty that we have with Great Britain. And so because of that, we have treaties that require us to honor each other's laws. So he is now technically a fugitive. Hapgood says that he has been threatened since he returned here to Connecticut, and the family says his life will be in danger if he returns to face authorities in the Caribbean. But Anguilla is a territory of Great Britain. It is not known yet if politicians will intervene to prevent the extradition proceedings that they will seek. In October, Callie Hapgood appeared on Fox and Friends asking President Trump to intervene. President Trump did put out a tweet saying, "Something looks and sounds very wrong. I know Anguilla will want to see this case be properly and justly resolved." Last month, Senator Richard Blumenthal tried to rally support outside Darien Town Hall, and he and Senators Murphy and Graham, as well as Representative Jim Himes, sent a letter to Michael Pompeo, the Secretary of State, expressing their concerns for Hapgood's safety and fair treatment. But thus far, the charges have not been dismissed, and technically he's a fugitive from justice. In the Hearst media today, they write that we don't know a few things, a few answers on this case. Number one, hotel workers waited 45 minutes before calling police after the Hapgoods reported the incident. We don't know whether or not Hapgood's children gave a statement to police. And the New York Times reports that toxicology reports show that Mitchell had a significant amount of cocaine in his bloodstream, more than what is commonly known as a lethal dose. So that's the Hapgood case. So between the Hapgood case and the Dulos case, we've got two pretty high-profile, different kinds of crimes and different kinds of criminal investigations that are going on right in our community here. I'm going to return now to Marie Yovanovitch a little bit in live testimony from the impeachment inquiry in Washington, D.C.
And I hope that real Republicans step forward and help the people that are just following blindly and standing behind this president and the Republican Party in Congress. What they're doing is so wrong for our government.
That's a little bit of Marie Yovanovitch's testimony. That was actually from an hour or two ago. They're currently on another break. I'm watching C-SPAN live, cspan.org, in case you want to watch it as well. It's about 5 minutes before noon, and we're coming up on a Friday. I do love a Friday. And what I love about this weekend is that I don't have that many plans. I was supposed to go to Philadelphia. Get this. I was supposed to go to Philly, and 2 weeks ago, I tried to get an Amtrak train reservation to go from either Stamford or Manhattan to Philadelphia. Do you know that I could not find a seat on a train 2 weeks ago? Would you say that that means there aren't enough train seats that go from here to Philadelphia? I mean, obviously, Philly is on the way to D.C., but it's also its own city. I could not get a seat. Forget about first class, not for whatever. Unless the Amtrak site was persistently broken, they would not sell me a seat on the train to Philadelphia for any time today, this Friday of this weekend. Is that insane? Really? I couldn't get on a train. And the idea of driving, well, my husband shut it down right away. He said, "Lisa, you're not driving to Philly. Have you ever driven into inside Philadelphia? Forget it. It's not happening." So I'm not going to Philly, but in a way I'm happy because it means that I have free time, which is rare for me. So I'll be doing my normal Saturday morning activity, which consists of Kiwanis and then yoga. And then tomorrow evening, I'll go to a Kiwanis event in Weston celebrating, I think it's our 45th year of the club. And on Sunday, I have a very sad day. On Sunday, I'm already getting ready for my sad day. That's why I'm going to go to the Richfield Playhouse Sunday night. Because Sunday afternoon, I'm going to a wake of the brother of one of the interns that helps us out here on the Lisa Wexler Show and on the Accorda Scientific Excellence Show, which I urge you to listen to tomorrow at 7:30 in the morning. Fabulous show where I interview these brilliant high school scientists. It's so much fun. But anyway, this gentleman's, this young man's brother died at Tufts University, and the circumstances have not been disclosed. And it is such a terrible tragedy. And that's where I'll be spending Sunday afternoon paying my respects. So I'm already getting ready for the heavy-hearted kind of sadness. And I didn't know the boy, and I don't even know his parents, but I know the brother who will now be an only child in the family. And it's so excruciatingly painful altogether to imagine that kind of yawning grief and despair. The despair altogether. So Anyway, I wish you a better week and a happier one. That's why I spoke about Sophia Loren coming into town. You can hear Charlie Daniels and his whacking crazy band. There are so many things that are fun and easy and wonderful to do and not that expensive. Tickets are around, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 bucks. It's well worth it to go to a lot of these events. I know the movie that I'm going to be going to Sunday evening to see Amy Curlin and meet her and hear about the Bluebird Cafe. It's 10 bucks. I think it's cheaper than going to the Bowtie Cinemas, right? How much does it cost to go to the movies nowadays? So anyway, I hope you're having a good time this weekend. Make the most of it. Enjoy your health and being with your friends and your family and just getting some fresh air here in Connecticut. Paul Pacelli with you, accompanying you in your day's journey from 2 to 6 p.m., talking about what's happening in Connecticut and beyond. And Clark Howard from noon to 2, right here on WICC 600, WICC600.com. And do upload our show on SoundCloud.com. Do follow us. All that good stuff. Christian does a great job of putting up hours 1 and 2. We'll be back behind the mic on Monday.